Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 200, I chat with Gene Dolgoff, Kyle Hertzens, and Robert Herron about the past 4 years and the future of audio-video technology. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded April 3rd, 2014. Episode 200, Days of Future Past. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the Home Theater Geek and editor of AVSForum.com. Welcome to episode number 200 of Home Theater Geeks. Woohoo!
Woohoo!
In fact, I have here the Vuvuzela, which Leo Laporte gave me, direct from the World Cup games in South Africa, and I thought I would play a little fanfare. Here we go.
Wow.
Now, you're not going to hear that at the World Cup. I guess this year it's in Brazil, and hopefully there will be a million Vuvuzelas there, because I love that sound. Everybody hates it, but I love it. But I'm so happy to have one from South Africa and to be able to play a little fanfare in honor of episode number 200. It's been over 4 years of Home Theater Geeks, and I'm so happy to have brought that to you and brought you all sorts of very interesting guests over those years. For this episode, I thought I would bring back three of our most popular guests who have appeared several times each over the course of those 4 years. First of all, we have headphone maven Tile Hertzens, the editor-in-chief of innerfidelity.com. Hey, Tile, welcome back.
Hi, Scott. Congratulations on number 200, and it's great to be here with you. Thanks a lot, man. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It's an honor to have you with me for this momentous occasion. Also with us is 3D maven Gene Dolgoff, and he's got some very interesting things to say today as well. Hey, Gene, welcome back.
Hi, how are you? Good to see you, and thank you so much for including me on this very important Emmy Award-winning episode.
Would that it were so. I wish it were. And finally, my good friend, technologist Robert Herron, who helped me calibrate Leo Laporte's OLED TV and plenty of other times has been on the show to talk about all sorts of things. Hey, Robert.
Hey, welcome. And thank you for inviting me. And congratulations on 200 very cool episodes. So much great content. And one of my favorite podcasts, honestly. I listen to it every week. I try to anyway.
Wow. Well, that's so – I'm honored to hear you say that, because you yourself do a podcast called HD Nation on Revision 3. And that's a great podcast, too. I really enjoy that one as well. So let's form a mutual admiration society, shall we?
Let's indeed.
I love you.
I love you, too, man. Oh. Okay.
You podiatrists need to get a room.
Yes, we are all podiatrists on this bus. So listen, those of you who are watching live at live.twit.tv or logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv can post questions for any of my guests today, and I will pass along as many as I can. In fact, I really encourage you to do that, because I would love to include the chat room as the fourth guest, essentially, of the show. The chat room has been so important over these last 4 years. I've always enjoyed having all of you along so much, and you always post a bunch of great questions from my guests, and today should be no different. In fact, the more you post, the happier I will be. I've got a few things to talk about with each of these guys, but really, the more you can help me out and post some questions for them to talk about, that would be really super cool. So let me start by asking each of you, you know, the show's been on for more than 4 years. We started December of 2009. And in all that time, the audio-video industry, the home theater industry, has made some significant progress. So, Ty, let's start with you. In the headphone world, how much have we progressed in the last 4 years? Certainly, we've seen a great resurgence in the interest in high-quality headphones. What's your take on it?
Well, I would say in terms of the world of headphones for audio, headphone audiophiles, I would say that the biggest thing that happened in the last 4 years is the advent of the planar magnetic headphones. So folks like Hi-Fi Man and Odyssey came out with planar magnetic headphones about 4 years ago, and now we're seeing Oppo has one, Fostex has just announced one, Odyssey has continued to improve their line of products and has made some pretty interesting technological strides. We also had the Abyss headphone from JPS Labs, which is a $5,000 planar magnetic. And Hi-Fi Man is just about to release some new single-sided, usually planar magnetics have magnets on both sides. The Abyss and now Hi-Fi Man has some planar magnetics that are single-sided magnets. And these headphones, they existed decades ago, but really have only been improved and looked at from an audiophile perspective in the last 4 years. So that's a pretty interesting thing coming around.
And what's the difference between planar magnetic and quote unquote regular, what we would call dynamic headphones?
Right. A dynamic headphone is like a speaker in the sense that it's got a diaphragm and a voice coil behind it that's mounted to the middle of the diaphragm, sort of. And a planar magnetic headphone, you could sort of liken it to an electrostatic driver. It's got a mylar diaphragm, and then on the diaphragm, in either a serpentine pattern or a spiral pattern, are traces are put on the diaphragm, electrical conductive traces that cause the diaphragm to move in the magnetic field that it's immersed in. So it's sort of like a mixture between electromagnetic drive of a dynamic headphone and a diaphragm, a planar diaphragm, like an electrostatic headphone.
Mm-hmm. And what's the advantage?
Well, I don't know that there's an innate advantage. Certainly, one advantage it has over electrostatic headphones is that you can impart a lot more force on the diaphragm than you can than an electrostatic headphone can. The electrostatic force is fairly weak. You also have very high voltage situation there that needs a special amplifier, and the planar magnetic headphones can work on a regular headphone amplifier, although they tend to want a little more power than regular dynamic headphones. Mm-hmm. It's nice to have a planar diaphragm as opposed to one with a rounded surface in the middle of it, because it creates a more planar wavefront that hits your ears and acts more like sound would in the real world. Mm. The downside is that they're typically very heavy because they have a lot of magnets in it. So planar magnetic headphones tend to be the heaviest of all headphones.
And are they generally more expensive as well?
Planar magnetic headphones?
Yeah.
Well, I would say they're similarly priced in terms of high-end headphones. They're planar magnetic headphones. High-end ones you can get sort of in the $800 to $2,000 price range. But there are planar magnetic headphones, the Fostex T50RP, that's been around for years and years and years, and that DIYers modify all the time. I think they're I'm not really sure, $150 or something like that. So they're relatively inexpensive.
Oh, that's not too bad. That's not too bad. No. You mentioned Oppo, and Caffeine Free Dave in the chat room is just getting here late, I should say. you mentioned Oppo, which is well known for Blu-ray players, but I just saw the press release as well. They're just come out with some planar magnetic headphones. Have you had a chance to listen to them?
No, they're on the way. They just received their first shipment of production headphones a couple of days ago. So, and I believe maybe I'm wrong about this, but I believe they're doing a headphone amp as well. So,
yeah, I believe so. I think Jason Lau, the one of the main guys there, told me that he's doing a headphone amp as well.
Yeah.
Well, great. Okay. Let me
Can I add one more quick thing? And that is to say that in the last 4 years, I think because of the attention of all the enthusiasts, I do think that headphone manufacturers are now also producing better quality headphones as a whole than they have in the past. So I think that's another thing that's happened over the last 4 years. I think headphones have in some ways have gotten better. So that I'm very thankful for as well.
Yeah, I am too. I moderated a panel at CES on the rebirth of high-end audio, and we were focusing a lot on headphones, and they seem to have led the renaissance into audiophilia, if you will, in the past headphones had been sort of not very good and people listened on speakers. Now people tend to want to listen on headphones because it's a very excellent experience.
I would agree with that, although I don't want to take up too much time, but I would have a lot to say on whether and to what degree headphones are helping a resurgence in high-end audio. I think it's a bit of a mixed bag, but in general, I would say it's good. Sure. A lot of new young folks. You bet.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, we have something else to talk about in a little while regarding high-end audio and its effect on the overall AV experience. But let me first turn to Gene and ask him, what do you think are the most important developments that have happened in the last 4 years from your perspective?
Well, we've seen the rise and fall of the consumer 3D market, I think.
I think you're right.
Yeah, it was in the beginning, well, in the beginning of the four-year period, it was on the rise. And we had the TVs with the polarized glasses that were passive. And then we had the shutter glasses TVs. And there were even some tries to make auto stereoscopic glasses free TVs. And the sales did go up and up, and they wound up probably selling 11 million sets nationwide, maybe more. But then it started to decline. And 3D has really fallen into the background for now. And that's been the significant occurrences in 3D in summary.
Yeah, I have to agree. A few years ago, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, 3D was the topic of CES. And then last year, it wasn't there at all. Vizio announced that they weren't putting 3D in any of their TVs. And yet, Hollywood continues to make 3D movies, particularly animation. Because they make money, I suppose. Yeah, they have to. They'd have to, or they wouldn't continue doing it. So
let me summarize for you why the 3D has fallen out of favor.
Please,
it's a combination of just a few reasons. One of them is, of course, that there has never been much 3D content available, so people don't want to go out and spend extra money to buy a 3D TV when there's just about nothing to watch on it in 3D. So that never picked up. There was always a hope that as they sold more 3D-ready TVs, and they in fact tried to sneak the 3D capability into all TVs, even if you didn't know you were getting it, you were getting 3D, with the intention that there would be a larger installed base of 3D TV owners, which would stimulate the studios to make more 3D content. But it wasn't enough. So there was not much 3D content made available ever, and that was a big negative. A second negative was a lot of people didn't like the glasses, and I didn't mind them, and a bunch of people didn't mind it. A lot of people did, and there were attempts to do glasses-free, but the glasses-free have inherent problems, which will never be overcome using that technology. Limited angle of view, jump, pseudoscopic zones, eye strain.
What are pseudoscopic zones? I don't think I've ever heard that term before.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, you have a limited number of views that are coming out of the set. So maybe there will be 7 or 9 views coming out of the set.
That's with auto stereo. That's with glasses
that's
free.
What I'm about. With auto stereo, you have 7 or 9 views. And once you move your head enough to get to the last view, and you move it a little more, now you're getting the first view of the next repeat of those nine views. And so the whole thing turns inside out in your brain, plus the first and ninth image don't match up anyway. So it's very disturbing. Mm-hmm. And so that what I'm saying is that audio stereoscopic technology will never take hold. So that didn't work. The other problems were that there is an inherent eye strain creator in any stereoscopic technology, which includes the auto stereo, and that is the misalignment or the misconvergence of your ability to see a focused image in one plane and see 3D images due to convergence in another plane. It's called accommodation and convergence, and they do not match in stereoscopic 3D. Your eyes do this, and so you can converge on different distances in front of the screen and back of the screen, but everything is always in focus on the screen. So the discrepancy between those two creates a real problem in the brain, and the further away the image is from the plane of the screen, the worse it is. So that's always a problem. In fact, it got to the point where all the major manufacturers of 3D TVs and games put out warning notices to cover themselves, saying
I saw those. That
children should not watch 3D stereoscopic video because it could actually hamper their development of stereoscopic vision. So
oh my God.
That was a big kick in the butt to 3D.
To 3D, no kidding. Now, have you seen just to talk about auto stereo for a second? There are two companies now working on it. Dolby is one. They've got something called Dolby 3D, which is glasses free. You look at the screen, you see 3D more or less. And the other is Stream TV Networks, which is based in Philadelphia. And they are going to be having product actually out on the market this year. Have you seen either of those systems?
I have not seen demonstrations of them. And in fact, I don't even know what Dolby is doing. But I have seen your show on Stream. That was recently.
Yes.
Ultra D. And that was an interesting show. And I really paid close attention to that show to try to understand what they have. And it appears to me that really all they have is auto stereo. It's 26 views, 24 views, but it's still auto stereo. It's still images that are taken from slightly different points of view, or in their software, they take a stereoscopic pair and create all those different points of view. I think his name was Walter, said that they had diffractive optics and refractive optics, and different subpixels are projected to different points in space.
Right. They're doing what they call a light field, which is not strictly lenticular, but
I can tell you the light field. Yeah, I don't buy it.
You don't buy it.
I don't buy it. What I was saying is I don't buy it because if you project the different subpixels at different depths, think about this. All you have to do is move your head, and now you see parallax between the subpixels, which don't match up anymore, and now you're breaking up the image, and you're seeing widening spaces, and it just won't work. That doesn't make any sense. Mm. And not only that, the distance between them in depth can't be very much, so you can't have very much sticking out or going back and have such giant spaces between subpixels. So really, I think all it is a larger number of views, but still auto stereoscopic. So that means if you're looking at two views, you're still getting a stereo pair. You're still having the mismatch between accommodation and convergence. So that, in my mind, is never going to cut it in terms of getting around the problems. And also, there are other things that go wrong when you only have two images and you're trying to get a match between convergence and accommodation. For instance, if something comes closer to you and the background stays, it changes the size relationship between the foreground object and the background object, and it will also change the depth relationship. That isn't reproduced properly, and there are many other things that won't be reproduced if you're using stereoscopic pairs. So
I'm going to try and arrange for you to see this a demo of Ultra D, because I have seen it, And I was pretty impressed. Now, you're the expert. You're the 3D expert. So I would love to get your impression of it, having actually seen it. We'll talk about that offline.
I would love to see it. Sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I'm talking theoretically in terms of where the market's going to go.
Yeah.
It won't be able to catch on with a stereoscopic solution. And even though it's audio stereoscopic, it's still stereoscopic at any given moment when you're in any one position.
Right.
So the glasses aren't liked, and the audio stereoscopic and the glasses still have these eye strain problems. And now they're pushing 4K so they can get away from it. So these are the reasons why 3D has gone on a downward slope.
Came and went. Well, entirely over the last 4 years. Well, yeah. I'm going to ask you a little later about what you see coming in the next 4 years. But first, I want to turn to Robert Herron and ask you, Robert, what have you seen as a major trend over the last 4 years?
I have to say, quality versus pricing is one of the big ones. That's a continuing trend across the display scene. We push for higher resolutions. The focus of some companies like ISF and THX and others to really get the quality in line as well with what the producers and directors and filmmakers are doing in the studio and in the film editing bay in terms of mimicking that quality at home has just come leaps and bounds. And it's gotten easier over the last few years in particular to achieve literally reference quality imagery in the home compared to having to go to the movie theater and hope the projectionist or whoever is monitoring the setup there is doing it right, let alone the variety of standards you see when it comes to just production on TV and the various qualities. Blu-ray helped a lot with that in the last few years. We now have, like, as far as we can get at least, a gold standard 8-bit video source that we can use as a reference to compare everything else we look at. And for me, that's made a big, big difference. And then just working hand in hand with manufacturers to have them incorporate better factory calibrations, provide the right sets of controls for achieving this image quality that we want, at least if you know what you're looking for. Or if you just want to recreate that cinema experience as closely as possible and enjoy that in the home. Then for me, I just want to make sure that I am sucking out every bit of detail from the source material I have available to me and seeing it as much as is, especially when you want to do comparisons between different products as well. It's nice to have reference quality display systems, let alone ways of delivering it to us. And lately, I also have to say, I'm just generally impressed by how compression technologies seem to keep up pretty well with how quickly we advance from VHS resolution on through DVD, on to HD and Ultra HD, all the way till now. They seem to be, with every generation of H.26, whatever, they seem to be cutting the needed bandwidth by about 50% with each generation. Granted, and it usually tends to improve over the cycle of that product as well. So even over the life of DVD video, we saw at the very beginning rather rough looking transfers, if you can even call them that, compared to the very end where the encoders on the back end were so much better than where they are today, or where they were at the time when they first were introduced, that the quality going in became so much better that then it became literally at the time a reference quality product. But also with display sizes too, we're also getting past that transition period, I think, of where the last great big screen for the home for a lot of people was rear projection technology. And its inherent limitations with uniformity problems, overscan issues, and a whole host of other things that, granted, it was a great value at the time, but I am so happy to see that going the way of the dinosaur now. And having these affordable large format screens from a variety of companies now.
Yeah, and not so expensive either. I mean, some of them are certainly, but
The Chinese and the Taiwanese manufacturers for that. The two biggest panel pushers for 2014, for 4K panels at least, will be the two big Taiwanese manufacturers, for like a CMO in particular, and I want to believe it's Innolux, the other one. They're responsible for, I believe, close to 60% of all the 4K panel shipments that'll be happening this year. And that includes them also selling to some of the biggest manufacturers of all in how they fill out their product lines. You know, not every manufacturer is making every size of a panel that they may need, so that they will then, you know, source from other places as well. But in turn, this is at least getting us big screens, bright screens, and we're also past that hump too, where there were so many oddball TV makers popping up left and right with quality across the board that's kind of shook itself out by this point. And we're down to just at least anybody who's left is at least offering some better quality than we were seeing before in terms of following the specs, like 4HD video production, let alone cinematography video production, and trying to bring that into the home as well. But all of that. And also, lossless audio has got to be my other favorite thing in the last couple of years. Just the proliferation of the format itself between Dolby and DTS and their respective lossless audio formats. That to me is as big of a deal as looking at Blu-ray video, or let alone a 4K video source coming up for a lot of us too. But if you haven't heard the switch going from just regular Dolby Digital to Dolby True HD or DTS HD Master Audio, that's as night and day as it is going from DVD to Blu-ray. And it's something I think everyone should be able to experience. And I think the cost too, overall, there's a lot of great entry-level AV receivers that do all of that decoding for you automatically and help simplify the experience, in addition to some killer sound speaker sets too that you can have very affordably on up to, you know, you can always spend all you want on any of this gear, but there are some terrific entry-level options now for just the average consumer, so you don't really have to sacrifice. And
the price to performance ratio has improved, which, let's see, price over performance, that ratio is going down. Performance over price, that ratio is going up, where you're getting more performance, higher, better performance for less money over the last 3 years. I certainly see that as a trend as well.
I agree completely. And just the basics, too, in terms of picture control and picture setup. A lot of manufacturers are at least providing either a decently calibrated preset or the ability to do it yourself. They're not hiding these controls anymore or making them too obfuscated. Right. And that's something I do appreciate. And they're also paying attention. Some of the biggest manufacturers are now really focused on, hey, look, we've been trying for years to make sure all the pixels are doing the right things and looking as best as they can, but sometimes we have to take it into our own hands and develop our own chipsets in-house and fine-tune them accordingly. But overall, too, we have other companies like Broadcom, which supply these chipsets to many, many manufacturers. So recently, all of these little black boxes that have been appearing that have, you know, 1080p output with an HDMI port, they support 30 formats internally with a USB input. Generally speaking, a lot of those boxes are powered by chipsets from companies like Broadcom, and that has just made an explosion of new products, let alone things like the Android operating system and the variety of little sticks you can stick into the back of a TV, be it HDMI or USB based or whatever. Those things are just exploding left and right now, and it's adding to our options that are available.
You know, I wonder, though, if having so many options actually leads to consumer confusion and maybe even, I don't want to say gridlock exactly, but, you know, there are so many choices that it might cause some people to just go, I don't know what to get. Forget it. I'm not going to get anything.
Truly. And it's easy to waste money because there's so many products now are duplicating features. Some of the best TVs, like I recently looked at Samsung's F8000 LCD. That has a quad-core processor built into it with an app store that rivals just about any other product I've looked at in terms of a third-party box you could connect to the TV separately. So if you had that TV and suddenly you're like, oh, you know what? Maybe I want the new Amazon box. But you might not realize that your TV already has like 90% of that functionality built into it now. And identical performance in terms of being able to have a speedy interface, the content you want to receive and the proper formatting for it. You know, it is easy then to just keep stacking device upon device into the home theater scene. And I keep thinking back too to how every Blu-ray player now incorporates an app store. Every new smart TV is going to have that built in. Some have cameras built in and things like that. So if you had an older device, I almost appreciate these little boxes that maybe can provide a faster experience overall. But otherwise, yeah, there's a lot of duplication going on right now. And it's really easy to end up with a pile of stuff that you might be using for one trick here, one trick there. And it'd be nice to have that all self-contained into a simplified experience for someone through a single device. And that's something really that game consoles too, that especially the last two generations of game consoles from Microsoft and Sony have really just pushed in terms of capabilities and as a platform for developers to experiment with building these apps out on a relatively beefy thing, when you think about it, modern game consoles, they're effectively pretty decent computers for what they are.
Seriously.
And they're able to then push some of their best work as far as app development goes through those platforms. And that will eventually trickle down to the other devices that might not have quite the horsepower to run those products. But that, too, is just, you know, it's another one of those, well, there's yet another source of apps. But at the same time, it's like a reference box in a sense where you can say, well, I expect at least X level of performance with my apps. I don't want to wait 5 minutes for something to start up. I don't want to wait, you know, the stream to take 2, 3, 4 minutes to go from standard def to high def. There's so much going on, too. And I really hope that these devices also help incorporate ways of just helping the user not only deal with what they have a little bit easier, but to provide in a very visual way verification that you're getting the best possible experience, too. Maybe you have a better Netflix player in your game console than you do in your TV, but or compared to your Blu-ray player, and let alone if you have a Chromecast stick or whatever. There's just so many sources for some of these apps now. That's really my concern, is either you're repeating a purchase or you're maybe perhaps buying a product that might seem like a good value at the time, but you had something faster and more capable in yet another product you just might not be aware of. So I totally agree. There's a lot of confusion to be had in terms of just the selection and the variety and the paywalls around certain products too. Like you take like Amazon in particular is the one I love to point at. They have yet to write an Amazon video app for Android, yet they have an Android Marketplace store. They'd love you to shop on your Android phone there, and I can watch.
But you can't get Amazon Instant Video on an Android device. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. For probably Amazon's own Kindle devices, their Fire devices in particular. I believe
the brand new Amazon Fire TV.
Exactly.
Which is this new little box that competes directly with Roku 3 and Apple TV.
And those are heavy hitter companies that have good interfaces, decent performance, similar remote systems, and yet another $100 box that's becoming pretty difficult, in my eyes at least, to differentiate from its competition. And gaming is one part of it. You know, Amazon is going to provide a $40 game controller with theirs, but anybody building one of these similar boxes could do something just like that. And that remains to be seen of how popular that can become. But for me, it's all about the streaming video sources. And to me, as someone who's trying to get away from paid subscription TV services and going to more of internet-based streaming video services, I'm really looking forward to that. And this is my first year where I've really kind of jumped ship from cable or satellite and just tried to do it all online. And it's been an interesting trip so far, and I'm looking forward to seeing how the rest of the year pans out with some of the services that are out there now and how they improve.
Right. Well, this is certainly one of the big trends that have happened in the last 4 years, is the move from cable and satellite to online service. And I know that you're working for yourself to try and get away from those older technologies and look online. What is your impression of the comparison of quality of the streaming content versus the broadcast content?
With all the streaming services, in particular for sports and video programming, at least the sports programming, like, for example, MLB TV's app and service, that gives you about 720p-ish quality stream. I see more pixelation and more compression in those sources than I do others, but it seems to change a little bit with every software update too. So every time they update the package on there, it seems to get a little bit better. And then I'm also at the whim of congestion during, you know, peak traffic times as well. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter how fast my home internet connection is. If me and a million other people are all trying to watch one specific thing at the same time, that can hammer just about any network I'm aware of. And sometimes it can cause the system to fail. So that's something you typically don't run into as often with your paid TV services, where you're either getting a signal from space or from your cable wire coming in through the wall. But those are some of the issues I'm running into as well. And going forward, I still see Blu-ray as the best quality video, period. I mean, you just have such a bandwidth bucket there in terms of about 40 megabit compared to what the average sustained, if you wanted, compared to what you could do over the internet, which most people do not have 40 megabit sustained, at least down, let alone up. So those are the big deals for me. I mean, Amazon 4K video, there are some clips out there already you can take a look at, but, you know, that's just a lot more bandwidth, and I think a lot of it will depend in terms of overall quality. How these players, in terms of the internet service providers and the peering agreements and all the other, you know, deals that go on to make those services work, how will that play out in terms of, you know, it is basically, if you want to supply video on the level of a Netflix, are you going to have to pay all of the people running that last mile of fiber or cable into a person's home in order to ensure adequate bandwidth for the provided service in general? Because right now it seems like, well, the minute that Netflix coughed up to Comcast, suddenly all the problems went away in terms of, you know, prime time viewing. Suddenly it wasn't an issue, and Comcast is like, yeah, you know, we probably have five times more bandwidth we're just sitting on, but as long as we can charge you $60-$70 a month for an internet connection, you know, that's the way it is. And, you know, if money is no object, you know, so be it. But
so fine for a lot of people, it is for most people.
Yeah, for a lot of people.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, Tile. Robert talked about the emergence and growth of uncompressed audio, which I assume you would be able to hear very easily on headphones. Do you agree that that's another important thing that's happened over the last 4 years?
Sure. I mean, it's. I think there's been a lot of work done with audio on the video side. DTS and all those folks are doing some really terrific stuff. And Scott, did you see that study that DTS did about listener satisfaction to video program material on tablets? And it was a company called Neural Insight, I think, or something like that. And
yeah, I saw that. I saw that. I think you've done some. You've written about it. Tell us about it.
Yeah, first of all, it was a study that was commissioned by DTS of a company that's a commercial market research company, and basically they put these brainwave monitoring hats on your head, and they look for pleasure. They are able to tell when you're having pleasure by your brainwaves. And the study that DTS commissioned, they had people watch video or movies on a tablet, and they would change the video resolution of it, and then they would change the audio resolution. In this case, they were changing from I'm not really sure what it was, but it was some relatively compressed audio to DTS Headphone X, which is a pretty large jump. And what they found was that as video resolution changed, there was virtually no change in viewer pleasure. But as audio performance changed, there was a significant change in viewer pleasure. Now, I would say the study's a little bit biased because of the way it was set up, and it was set up specifically for DTS.
Right.
But it does seem to me that there's something very, very different about our visual system and our auditory system. And Robert was the name of your other guest on the 3D television?
Oh, no, it's Gene.
Gene, he was talking about eye strain having to deal with the 3D-ness of the television. And there were some very technical, very objective things that he could say about what your visual system was doing and how it was having a difficult time with that technology. On the other hand, if you think about it, in your acoustic sensory system, is fairly soft. I mean, people listen to really crappy MP3 formats all the time, or boom boxes, and still get a great deal of enjoyment out of it. And I think there's this sort of decoupling between objective performance and the nature, the quality of the stimulation, where video has a very objective character about it. What you enjoy about it is conscious, but audio has this subjective part of it where you may not even know how well you're being pleased or not by it, or it's a very, very strange thing. And go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say it is a very strange thing. I wonder if you're aware of some studies that I heard of. I've been trying to find them, and I haven't been able to yet. Maybe somebody in the chat room can point me in that direction, of the emotional impact of MP3 versus uncompressed audio. And there are many who believe, and there are some studies, I believe, that back this up, that MP3 audio has much less emotional impact, that people feel much less emotional resonance when listening to MP3s, a highly compressed audio, as opposed to uncompressed full range audio. Have you heard of this?
I haven't, but it seems to me that DTS study points in that direction, and I you know, it's interesting to look at televisions, you know, and you go into Costco now and you see this huge array of very big televisions, and the consumer gets it. The consumer gets, oh, big television must be better. It's more like the movie. And then there isn't the same direct understandable relationship between fidelity of audio reproduction and the enjoyment the person has at home. So I think it's going to be an interesting thing to see how the relationship between audio and video play out over time. And I'll add in this, just to stimulate a little more conversation with the other guests, that one of the things that's happening now is Apple is patented and looks to be producing sometime in the relatively near future earbuds that have biometric sensors in them for temperature and sweat and all that kind of stuff, but also have accelerometers and position sensing detectors that allow them to know where your head is moving. So the phone knows where it is because of GPS and sensors in the phone. You look at the phone and there's a facial recognition, and then you can say to the phone, "What's over there?" And you can just turn your head and the phone will know, because it's connected to the position sensing detector, what you're looking at. So there's some navigational things and interesting things that happen. But one of the things that happens as soon as position sensing detectors are common in headphones is that you may be able to get input for head tracking of changing of psychoacoustic localization during movies. So you can have the thing that most allows you to believe psychoacoustic cues that are trying to synthesize surround is the ability to move your head relative to them, those cues, and have the cues change. And of course, in headphones, you can't normally do that unless there's a position sensing detector. So
this reminds me of the Smith Realizer, which is a box that simulates the sound of a surround speaker system around you, and it has a head tracker on it that when you move around, the virtual speakers seem to stay in the same place. And I wonder if this development from Apple, putting positional sensors in the little earbuds or whatever, might lead to a less expensive version of that. This is kind of what you're talking about, right?
Well, absolutely. And as soon as they put it in their earbud that they package in with their product, what will of course happen is there will be aftermarket versions of this that you can attach to a headband or something like that and get into the cable so that the iPhone or whatever it is can receive the information, because obviously this information is going to be going down the cable. So I would suspect that as soon as Apple starts actually producing this and it comes out, that you'll see aftermarket devices and headphones that start having these type of functions in it. So going back to one of the things that's being said here, back in the day, a stereo system was two speakers and a bunch of stuff in your living room. And now that's kind of gone. Well, now we have a big TV in our living room. But with Retina display iPads and you're holding it this far in front of your face, well, you know, that's as big as a big screen TV out there. Are we not seeing large movements of media consumption going on to tablets? And are we going to see the disappearance of the TV home theater system sort of altogether in the home? I mean, we're seeing a lot of movement away from traditional technologies, and I'm very curious what the other participants here today would say about that type of thing.
Well, actually, I know that Gene has something interesting to say about exactly that. Gene, when you sent me a video of what might be something like the next generation, a reference that I'll talk to you about here in a moment. Set this video up for us, and then maybe we'll play a minute or so of it.
Okay. One of the directions that everything is going in is to include what's called augmented reality, which means that you can see reality and superimposed on that, which Google Glass is sort of doing, is some other things. So superimposed in the real world. So this video shows you, take a look at this. This is an actual mall in Dubai, and these people are in the mall. And before I tell you what's really going on, just take a look at some of this.
It's quite remarkable, actually. Those of you, by the way, the people who are listening to this podcast after the fact won't be able to see this, unfortunately. So I'll do a little bit of a description here. We're looking at a video of some people in a mall, and a dinosaur walks by, and a cheetah walks by and lies down. And the kids that are looking at this are quite fascinated, of course, and trying to pet the thing. But it's not really there. There's a rhinoceros that comes in and kind of pokes around. And the kid's getting a little scared, and his father's saying, no, no, it's okay. Don't worry about it. It's not really there.
Yeah, it's an amazing illusion. But what's happening is the dangerous animals are superimposed on the reality. Now, look at this dolphin or shark. Yeah, dolphin. It comes right
dolphin.
Out of the floor.
Yeah, comes out of the floor.
But notice now, they're not looking at the dolphin. They're looking towards us. And so really what they're looking at is a screen that shows an image of them and superimposes these images. So that guy who's got his phone, look at the clouds forming now.
There's a cloud forming overhead, yeah.
Yeah, and there's a guy standing there who's filming this whole thing, and you can see him in the back there holding it up. And so they're really looking at a screen.
So what we're looking at, yeah, we're looking at the image that he shot of a screen in front of him. With him in the image because the image includes him. Here comes a guy in a spacesuit walking by, and it looks like he's just walking by this group of people. It's incredible.
Now watch this guy. He's going to walk through the astronaut.
Oh, that's right. He goes chases after his little kid.
He just walks. Look at that.
Yeah.
so all of a sudden he goes under the astronaut and passes through him so he can get his son back.
This clearly reminds me of the holodeck in Star Trek. And I wanted to make sure to let everybody know that recently on, I think it's StarTrek.com, there's an interview with you, Gene Dolgoff. And the reason that they interviewed you was that you were the one who suggested to Gene Roddenberry the idea of the holodeck.
Right, and explained to him how it would work. And so they used it in the Next Generation and so on after that. The holodeck, of course, is the ultimate consumer display theater product, you know, and we all want to have that. And one day that will be available, but we're moving in that direction. And at another time, I can talk to you about how it will work and technically and what are the – because there's lots of questions about, you know, what happens if you – drink some of the holographic water and then you go out, do you still have to go to the bathroom? Or, you know, so many questions. And I can answer these things because I understand how it works. But
yeah.
let me just bring us a little closer to the present and tell you about the future of 3D, the near future of 3D.
Please, because I don't think we're going to see the holodeck in the next 4 years, are we?
No, certainly not. But I'm now going to go out on a limb and give a directive to the world. The problems that have to be solved, which they are already solved, but they have to be incorporated into a 3D product. There are four issues that have to be incorporated. One, of course, is you get rid of the glasses. People don't like that. And if they're going to be in a group experience, which is more fun, instead of having a little tablet that you hold, you have a big screen in the room and everybody's watching that together. So they want to turn around and see each other's expressions. The glasses get in the way of that. So they want to get rid of the glasses. Second thing is you have to get rid of the mismatch between the accommodation and the convergence so that whatever you're converging on, you're focused there. And that'll get rid of the eye strain issues. That's the second thing. Now, the third thing, which is very important, is we can call it the sweet spot problem, both horizontally and Z direction. So, for instance, there's only a limited amount you can move back and forth on today's auto stereo displays. It's got to be more. It's got to be a nice wide angle of view, maybe even several feet that you can walk around the room and see it. So you need a wide horizontal field of view, but also you need a wide Z direction capability. Right now with auto stereo, you have to be at a certain distance from the screen to get the proper 3D perspective. If you go a little closer or further away, it starts to fall apart. You start to get the wrong kind of 3D, and then you get no 3D. So that has to be fixed. So that's a sweet spot problem, both in Z and in Y. Then you have to have something that I discovered, simultaneous planes. That means that you have to be able to see objects at different planes that are converged differently, simultaneously, that you can change by changing your convergence. So in other words, if you're looking at a foreground object, and that's, by the way, very important. There's got to be a lot of objects popping out of the screen. That's what people want to see. And nowadays with auto stereo, the more it comes out of the screen, more eye strain you have, and so that's no good. But if you cancel the problem of mismatch between accommodation and convergence, the more out of the screen, the better, because the more participation you have with the scene. You want to be able to move your hand through objects. That's important. But also, you got to have things at other depths at the same time. And what happens is, if you're looking at an object at one depth, it'll be sharp, it'll be a single image. Stuff at other depths will be blurry and double image. That's part of reality. The stereoscopic 3D cannot reproduce that. So you
I have heard that complaint before that the director or the director of photography determines what you need to focus on by what is in focus, and things elsewhere are out of focus, and you can't change that. Whereas in reality, of course, you can.
Right. And that it's not just a preference. Our sense of reality requires the ability to keep switching back and forth between one plane and another plane and another plane. And we do it constantly, unconsciously. And that gives us a sense of reality. If you don't have that ability, you don't sense that this is reality. And it actually gives you eye strain, because if you're converged in too narrow a distance, your muscles are holding your eyes at a certain angle, and any muscle that you hold at a certain tension for too long will start to hurt, and toxins build up, and it's not like real life. So those problems have to be addressed to make a successful 3D system. And I've addressed them, I've already solved them, but so have other people. And of course, you know the best way to do this is holography. Holography right. solves these problems. All of these problems are solved with holography. Problem with holography is the bandwidth is way too big to be able to send that to somebody. Or even if you had a Blu-ray player, it's too big. You need to do something different. And what they're doing now, like, for instance, MIT Media Lab and so on, they are trying to reduce the amount of, like they give you two eye holes in space, and the holographic information is sent to those places. And if you move your head, they do head tracking. So they're really not giving you all those angles of information, because that would be too much. But that's still not quite good enough. And the solution, which I've found, is hybrid holographic. And I believe you were at my office and saw one of our early prototype systems. Isn't that right, Scott?
I did, yes. I was at your office, and I did see some of those prototypes, and they're quite remarkable.
If the image floats in the air and you move your hand.
The image floats in the air, yeah, exactly. But it is still within a very well-defined, bounded region, not like the holodeck, which is basically all around you. But again, as you say, we're looking now a little nearer term, and do you think that anything like that will become available in the next 4 years, or are we talking 10 years out?
Yeah, that's what I'm writing a patent on right now, which is the next generation of the thing you saw in my office. It's a hybrid holographic system. It gives you the images in front, so it's out in the air. You can put your hand through it, as you've seen. There is no eye strain, right? You saw it. There was no eye strain at all.
As I recall, that's correct, yeah.
There was because convergence and accommodation were always correlated, and there was no glasses, and there was a very wide angle, not only horizontally, but front and back. I don't know if you remember. You started from all the way in the back of the room and then walked all the way forward. It was about 20 feet or so, and the 3D did not change. That
no, it's true. It's absolutely true.
That's how it'll work, and that'll come out in the next few years.
Hmm. Brexville Ron in the chat room is asking, what's the bandwidth on something like that?
Believe it or not, it can be over an existing TV bandwidth because of the chips that are done. And the fact that now we have such powerful chips, we can do a lot of that processing in the TV. So you don't have to send that much information, and then you build it up in the TV, and now you can build up a lot of angles of light. The whole secret of holography is light rays have to go at the right angles, and each one of those light rays has to have the proper brightness and color information. That's what I call the ABCs of light. Angle, brightness, and color of each light ray is unique, and as long as you can reproduce that information, now you'll see the same thing you would see if you saw the thing in real life.
Incredible. Robert, if you could buy a holographic TV, would you?
That's a good question. If you had the content available. And, ooh, am I frozen? I might be frozen.
Looks like the video froze.
Uh-oh. But if you can still hear me.
I can, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Not go sure right ahead.
My video.
Uh-oh. Dang. That you make a great point, though, about if the content is available. Because that was one of the things that Gene talked about not being a problem with the current 3D situation was the content wasn't available.
Also, just plain fidelity, things like image contrast and color saturation and other things like that. If you can produce an image that can match what I'm seeing today out of some of the best display technologies, no doubt that is something I want to take a look at. I like the idea of a formed 3D object in front of you that you have. You are eliminating a lot of the problems that you had before in terms of convergence and having it look right. I remember we did a trip down to DreamWorks down in Los Angeles, where we spent time with one of the 3D engineers, where they said their time now is just spent mostly making sure that the eye isn't doing bad things in terms of depth calculations and where objects are placed on screen. And it's become artistic intent at this point as to what they want you to see. It's not real in any way, shape, or form. You have that single plane of view, and if you're not paying attention to that, or if you're you get distracted just even for a moment, that increases the amount of strain and stress that you're having in the viewing experience. And as soon as those things go away, and as soon as I can have something that looks even close to what they're doing as far as, Star Trek-ish or holography, that has a lot of compelling, that compels me beyond a lot of things, especially for gaming or anywhere where you're dealing with high speed imagery, where you're not necessarily, looking for every stinking pixel defect you can find, but more about just immersing yourself in the content and anything that can get us to a point where you can have a truer 3D experience in terms of an object. You can really change the depth at will and look around, even if it's for a couple extra planes. I think that would go a long way toward helping what's going on right now. And just the other thing that they are currently doing with today's 3D systems is providing that dual view experience for two people. Rather than have a single 3D image that everyone's experiencing, you have multiple 2D images based on the refresh rate of the screen. And that's something that's available today that's using the existing technology that can further just the use of the product in a way that...
But you need to still wear glasses.
That is true. And that likely isn't going to go away until we have something else. I have yet to be very impressed by any of the glasses-free technology that I've seen, but hopefully that will change.
And hopefully so.
Robert, that's why you have to see our prototypes of our quasi-holographic system. No glasses, no eye strain, and now you can move the image comes out and you can move your hand through the image. That's much more real, and I think that's got to be before it's accepted widely by the public and by the studios, who will then say, okay, this is good. Let's make content for it. And plus the ability to create the 3D in the TV set with the high amount of chip capabilities that will allow it to be sent as a lower fidelity signal and then bumped up to the proper 3D and fidelity in the set.
That, That sounds awesome, Gene. I also look at it, too, from a perspective of if 3D as it currently exists works best if you have two eyes with very similar capabilities. If you have one eye that's a little bit different than the other, or you have any kind of other vision issues, too, that's where you almost need something like a holographic system.
That's right. With stereoscopic, you're stuck. One eye's view is so critical to the other eye's view, you can't move your head and get a sampling of different information. But with non-stereoscopic, you can.
Gene, is there a way to take existing 3D program material and put it together in such a way that your holographic system can display it, even though possibly not as good as material that was created directly for it?
Hmm. Yeah, it's due to the processing power that is now available. That allows you, because once you have a stereo pair defined, you now really do have a depth map of most everything in the scene. Not everything, because there are some hidden things that, once you go for parallax, you have some hidden surprises that won't be there. But with a smoothing program, you can fill those with adjacent pixel data and nobody knows. So,
but you're not going to bring into focus the stuff in the background, though, right? Because that's out of focus on the original material.
No. You can. Once you have a depth map which says, these things are 3 feet away, these things are 3 feet 1 inch away, this is 6 feet away, whatever, now you can create the light rays going at the right angles. See, what I'm trying to explain here in too little time, is the light rays going at all these different angles that allows your eyes to focus on those light rays and see things at different distances and have them be in focus. That's how the light field camera works.
Except for the fact that, as Tile pointed out, the director has made a decision in current existing 3D material on what is going to be in focus and what is going to be out of focus. So even if you have a depth map that says this thing is behind this other thing, the thing that's behind it was filmed, shot out of focus compared to the thing in front of it. So how can that then become in focus?
Well, for the next 4 years, I totally agree with you. But okay.
For the future,
we have technology deconvolution and resharpening of images. The only reason it's out of focus is because the lens function was creating a different distribution of the light. Holographically, you can change that distribution of light so that it is in focus. That's how we took the pictures of the moon before we landed on the moon, and some of them were out of focus. In a computer, we were able to refocus them and compensate for not only motion artifacts, but lenses being focused at the wrong distance. The data is still there, and if you use the principles of coherent optics, you can resharpen it.
That's interesting.
FOIA optics or something like that, where they can fascinating.
Hey, Tile, I wanted to ask you before we end, and we're getting right towards the end here. We've been talking about 3D video. What about 3D audio? That is what we sometimes call immersive audio or 3D audio. In a theater, it's not so hard. You put speakers all around you.
Right.
But in headphones, how easy or difficult is it? I know DTS Headphone X has attempted to do this.
Right.
How successful is that in your ears, so to speak? And how much better do you think it might be able to get?
Well, you brought up the Smith Realizer earlier on, and it really does do a good job. But in a way, they're using a brute force method where you sit with microphones in your ears in front of a home theater system, a surround system, and it plays various calibration signals and measures your ears and maps it all out. And so it's really custom made for you, and you have to go to a laboratory or a place where you can have your head-related transfer function sort of input into the system. So the real question is, without a personal calibration, how good can it get? Now, of course, if you've done the DTX demo, which is really an optimal experience of where they're at so far, you can hear that it's pretty darn good. But there's a couple of things about it. And one is that they have to very, very carefully calibrate their their playback to compensate for any errors in the headphone. And one of the things that DTS is now doing is working very hard with manufacturers to improve the quality of headphones. And you asked a little bit earlier, or mentioned that you wanted to hear what the next 4 years would bring. And I would have to say that in the world of headphones, by and large, it's rather a boring thing, which is just better performance. Because headphones for so long were accessories, we're actually really in the infancy, I think, or maybe in grade school period of the performance of headphones. And I think headphones are going to get a lot better in terms of performance, in part because there will be pressure from folks like DTS who want to do this virtual reality kind of stuff, and gaming manufacturers, and get that experience right on headphones. And in addition, in a very parallel way to what Gene was saying, if you don't have head movement, if your sensory system isn't allowed to experience the changes that would naturally occur when you do things, and in terms of visual, he said refocusing on things far and deep and moving from side to side. With headphones, it's the ability to move your head relative to a sound source, or with the auditory system, it's the ability to move your head relative to the sound source. And that is absolutely critical. And you don't need much head movement. 3 to 5 degrees is all you use to localize on stuff, and you don't even know that you're doing it. But if it's not there, you have about 1/10 the effectiveness. So the DTS Headphone X demo that you heard would be 10 times more effective if they could do the head tracking. And in terms of technologies and that being available to us, I mentioned earlier on that Apple's working on some position sensing detectors, and that might be showing up in headphones relatively soon. But in addition to that is the processing power in a tablet to do the subtle cue changes with head movement in 11 channels at the same time without any latency. And so I don't think the tablets are there yet, but I think by the time they get the headphone manufacturers making good enough headphones, let's say 2 or 3 years down the road, there probably would be the processing power to modify the signals and do the DSP on 11 channels at the same time to accommodate for head movement. And that should make for a really immersive and I think astonishing experience. And I can't imagine what it would be like to have some sort of a portable 3D holodeck, one of Gene's devices, a portable device like this with a headphone that does surround processing on it. And I would suggest to you that right now there's a lot of municipalities that are prohibiting and making laws against people walking around with headphones. And I would think that should this technology become available, that people are going to have to be very, very, very careful not to fall down elevator shafts and do stupid things.
People are already having accidents from walking and texting.
Yes, exactly.
Oh,
exactly.
Headphones. Headphones are being banned in municipal light rail stations in many, many places in the world. And when I do my headphone news feeds, 2 or 3 times a month, people are killed by light rail trains because they're wearing headphones. So
I want to, before we
be careful
before we
out
end,
there, folks.
Be careful out there, folks. Before we end, I want to just mention that a number of people in the chat room have talked about Oculus Rift, which is headset, right, where you have two separate displays in front, one in front of each eye, tiny little ones, and you're wearing this headset. I'm sure I don't know if it has earphones in it or not. It might. The company was just purchased by Facebook, of all things. But that may be for something like $1 billion. Yeah.
$2 billion.
$2 billion. Yes. That may very well be one way to get to 3D, certainly personal 3D, portable 3D. But I sure as heck wouldn't want to be walking around the street wearing that thing.
No, you can't. It's not the way to go.
Yeah, exactly. Well, listen, we've gone a little over time here, but because it's my 200th episode, I figured what the heck. So I want to thank you all very much. We've had a great conversation here. A lot more to talk about, so I hope to get you all back on the show in the future to get a little more in depth. But for now, I want to thank you all very much for being here.
Thank you for this great, momentous opportunity.
Whoa! Where's my vuvuzela?
Yeah. There we go. Yeah. Congratulations, Scotts. Hope you get 200 more.
Thank you. At least. Robert, thank you so much for being here.
Absolute pleasure, Scott. Thank you. And congratulations again on number 200.
200.
And maybe be doing this again at number 400 or 500.
You bet, man. You bet. And Gene, thank you also.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure. Let's do more.
Let's do. Yes. You can reach Tyle Hertzens at innerfidelity.com. Gene's website is 3-division.com. And Robert Herron is at herronfidelity.com. You can find me online, of course, at avsforum.com. And you can email me at scott@twit.tv. You can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott, also at avsforum. You can always find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here at twit.tv/HTG. Also on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/twit/HomeTheaterGeeks. Now, next week, I will have just returned from the NAB show in Las Vegas, National Association of Broadcasters, and Mike Heiss will be joining me to discuss what we will have seen and heard there, and if I can rope in one or two other people who aren't still already at the show on that Thursday, I'll bring them along, too, so that we can talk about all the great stuff that is coming out of the professional content creators realm. I'm going to be looking especially for 4K UHD information, not only about the number of pixels, which is kind of not that interesting to me, but high dynamic range, wider color gamut, greater bit depth, all the other things that I think are going to make UHD really something special. So I do hope you will join me for that. Until then, geek out.